wished to distract or alarm Moses with news of earlier, irrelevant extinctions. So by the early years of the 19th century, fossils had taken on a certain inescapable importance, which makes Wistar's failure to see the significance of his dinosaur bone all the more unfortunate. Suddenly, in any case, bones were turning up all over. Several other opportunities arose for Americans to claim the discovery of dinosaurs, but all were wasted. In 1806, the Lewis and Clark expedition passed through the Hell Creek Formation in Montana, an area where fossil hunters would later literally trip over dinosaur bones and even examined what was clearly a dinosaur bone embedded in rock, but failed to make anything of it. Other bones and fossilized footprints were found in the Connecticut River Valley of New England after a farm boy named Plinus Moody spied ancient tracks on a rock ledge at South Hadley, Massachusetts. Some of these at least survive, notably the bones of an Ankylosaurus, which are in the collection of the Peabody Museum at Yale. Found in 1818, they were the first dinosaur bones to be examined and saved, but unfortunately weren't recognized for what they were until 1855. In that same year, 1818, Caspar Wistar died, but he did gain a certain unexpected immortality when a botanist named Thomas Nuttall named a delightful climbing shrub after him. Some botanical purists still insist on spelling it Wistaria. By this time, however, paleontological momentum had moved to England. In 1812, at Lyme Regis on the Dorset coast, an extraordinary child named Mary Anning, aged 11, 12, or 13, depending on whose account you read, found a strange fossilized sea monster, 17 feet long, and now known as the Ichthyosaurus, embedded in the steep and dangerous cliffs along the English Channel. It was the start of a remarkable career. Anning would spend the next 35 years gathering fossils, which she sold to visitors. She is commonly held to be the source of the famous tongue twister, "She sells seashells on the seashore." She would also find the first Plesiosaurus, another marine monster, and one of the first and best pterodactyls. Although none of these was technically a dinosaur, that wasn't terribly relevant at the time, since nobody then knew what a dinosaur was. It was enough to realize that the world had once held creatures strikingly unlike anything we might now find. It wasn't simply that Anning was good at spotting fossils, though she was unrivaled at that, but that she could extract them with the greatest delicacy and without damage. If you ever have the chance to visit the Hall of Ancient Marine Reptiles at the Natural History Museum in London, I urge you to take it, for there is no other way to appreciate the scale and beauty of what this young woman achieved, working virtually unaided with the most basic tools in nearly impossible conditions. The plesiosaur alone took her 10 years of patient excavation. Although untrained, Anning was also able to provide competent drawings and descriptions for scholars, but even with the advantage of her skills, significant finds were rare, and she passed most of her life in poverty. It would be hard to think of a more overlooked person in the history of paleontology than Mary Anning, but in fact there was one who came painfully close. His name was Gideon Algernon Mantell, and he was a country doctor in Sussex. Mantell was a lanky assemblage of shortcomings. He was vain, self-absorbed, priggish, neglectful of his family, but never was there a more devoted amateur paleontologist. He was also lucky to have a devoted and observant wife. In 1822, while he was making a house call on a patient in rural Sussex, Mrs. Mantell went for a stroll down a nearby lane, and in a pile of rubble that had been left to fill potholes, she found a curious object, a curved brown stone about the size of a small walnut. Knowing her husband's interest in fossils, and thinking it might be one, she took it to him. Mantell could see at once it was a fossilized tooth, and after a little study became certain that it was from an animal that was herbivorous, reptilian, extremely large, tens of feet long, and from the Cretaceous period. He was right on all counts, but these were bold conclusions, since nothing like it had been seen before or even imagined. Aware that his finding would entirely upend what was understood about the past, and urged by his friend the Reverend William Buckland, he of the gowns and experimental appetite, to proceed with caution, Mantell devoted 3 painstaking years to seeking evidence to support his conclusions. He sent the tooth to Cuvier in Paris for an opinion, but the great Frenchman dismissed it as being from a hippopotamus. Cuvier later apologized handsomely for this uncharacteristic error. One day, while doing research at the Hunterian Museum in London, Mantell fell into conversation with a fellow researcher who told him the tooth looked very like those of animals he had been studying, South American iguanas. A hasty comparison confirmed the resemblance, and so Mantell's creature became Iguanodon, after a basking tropical lizard to which it was not in any manner related. Mantell prepared a paper for delivery to the Royal Society. Unfortunately, it emerged that another dinosaur had been found at a quarry in Oxfordshire and had just been formally described by the Reverend Buckland, the very man who had urged him not to work in haste. It was the Megalosaurus, and the name was actually suggested to Buckland by his friend Dr. James Parkinson, the would-be radical and eponym for Parkinson's disease. Buckland, it may be recalled, was foremost a geologist, and he showed it with his work on Megalosaurus. In his report for the Transactions of the Geological Society of London, he noted that the creature's teeth were not attached directly to the jawbone, as in lizards, but placed in sockets in the manner of crocodiles. But having noticed this much, Buckland failed to realize what it meant. Megalosaurus was an entirely new type of creature. So although his report demonstrated little acuity or insight, it was still the first published description of a dinosaur. And so to him, rather than the far more deserving Mantell, goes the credit for the discovery of this ancient line of beings. Unaware that disappointment was going to be a continuing feature of his life, Mantell continued hunting for fossils. He found another giant, the Hylaeosaurus, in 1833, and purchasing others from quarrymen and farmers until he had probably the largest fossil collection in Britain. Mantell was an excellent doctor and equally gifted bone hunter, but he was unable to support both his talents. As his collecting mania grew, he neglected